नमो भगवते वसुदेवाय reading Srimad Bhagavatam, Canto 5, Chapter 20, The Structure of the Universe, Text Number 6. Lakshadishu panchasu purushanam ayur indriyam mojam sahobalam budhir vikramaiti cha sarvesham otpattike siddhir adisheshena vartate. Okay, the translation. O king, longevity, sensory powers, physical and mental strength, intelligence and bravery are naturally and equally manifested in all the inhabitants of the five islands headed by Plakshadweep. Text number 7. I'll just read the translations. Plakshadweep is surrounded by an ocean of sugarcane juice, equal in breadth to the island itself. Similarly, there is then another island, Salmalidweep, twice as broad as Plakshadweep, 400,000 yojanas, or 3,200,000 miles, and surrounded by an equally broad body of water called Surasagara, the ocean that tastes like liquor. Text number 8. On Salmalidweep, there is a Salmali tree from which the island takes its name. That tree is as broad and tall as the Plaksha tree. In other words, 100 yojanas, 800 miles broad, and 1,100 yojanas, 8,800 miles tall. Learned scholars say that this gigantic tree is the residence of Garuda, the king of all birds and carrier of Lord Vishnu. In that tree, Garuda offers Lord Vishnu his Vedic prayers. Text number 9. The son of Maharaja Priyavrata, named Yajnabahu, the master of Salmalidweep, divided the island into 7 tracts of land, which he gave to his 7 sons. The names of those divisions which correspond the names of the sons are Surochana, Samanasya, Ramanaka, Devavarsha, Paribhadra, Aipayana, and Avigyata. Text number 10. In those tracts of land, there are 7 mountains: Svarasa, Satashringa, Vamadeva, Kunda, Mukunda, Pushpavarsha, and Sahasrashruti. There are also 7 rivers: Anumati, Sinivali, Sarasvati, Kuhu, Rajani, Nanda, and Raka. They are still existing. Text number 11. Strictly following the cult of Varnashrama Dharma, the inhabitants of those islands, who are known as Shrutidharas, Viryadharas, Vasundharas, and Ishandharas, all worship the expansion of the Supreme Personality of Godhead, named Soma, the moon god. Text number 12. The inhabitants of Salmalidweep worship the demigod of the moon in the following words. By his own rays, the moon god has divided the months into 2 fortnights, known as Shukla and Krishna, for distribution of food grains to the pitas and the demigods. The demigod of the moon is he who divides time, and he is the king of all the residents of the universe. We therefore pray that he may remain our king and guide, and we offer him our respectful obeisances. Text number 13. Outside the ocean of liquor is another island known as Kushadweep, which is 800,000 yojanas, 4,400,000 miles wide, twice as wide as the ocean of liquor. As Salmalidweep is surrounded by a liquor ocean, Kushadweep is surrounded by an ocean of liquid ghee, as broad as the island itself. On Kushadweep, there is a clump of Kusha grass, from which the island takes its name. the kusha grass, which was created by the demigods by the will of the Supreme Lord, appears like the second form of fire, but with very mild and pleasing flames. Its young shoots illuminate all directions. Purport. From the descriptions of this universe, of this verse, we can make an educated guess about the nature of the flames of the moon. Like the sun, the moon must also be full of flames, because without flames there cannot be illumination. The flames of the moon, however, unlike those of the sun, must be mild and pleasing. This is our conviction. The modern theory that the moon is full of dust is not accepted in the verses of Srimad Bhagavatam. In regard to this verse, Srila Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur says, Sushaspani sukomala shika stesham rochisha. The kusha grass illuminates all directions, but its flames are very mild and pleasing. It gives some idea of the flames existing on the moon. It's a very difficult verse to speak about. Srila Prabhupada says here, we can make an educated guess about the nature of the flames of the moon from this verse of Srimad Bhagavatam. But of course, the main meaning of this statement is that we, as devotees, or as people who believe in God, accept the words of Srimad Bhagavatam and its literal value. We don't speculate. We don't try to give some kind of symbolic explanation to these verses, which actually is very hard. You know, just imagine the ocean of liquid ghee in the universe. You know, one has to be pretty bold to believe in this. It's not something which you can immediately believe. What to speak about the ocean of liquor? Of course, some people would love to believe that there is an ocean of liquor, especially in Russia. Probably they go to this island to live there in their next lives. But the main meaning and the main gist of Prabhupada's explanation of this verse is that we have to accept this as a face value. This is what it is. This is what scriptures say. And we have to accept this. And if we don't accept this, we are Gnostic. We are basically atheist. To not accept the words of the scriptures and its face value is tantamount of saying that we don't accept God. And this has a very grave and serious consequences. Basically, there is only two points of view about the nature of this life, about the nature of the universe, about the nature of this world. And one is theistic, another one is atheistic. If we accept one, we have to reject another one. And this fifth canto of Srimad Bhagavatam was the description of the universe. In a sense, is a test of the depths of our faith. Because if we have doubts, and some people do have doubts, like we know this famous story about Prabhupada's personal servant who didn't believe that scientists never made it to the moon. Prabhupada was very clear. He said, in the Vedas it is said that the moon is the planet which is in charge of all the growth of all the vegetation in this earth, so how it can be a pile of dust? But his foolish servant was not intelligent enough to understand this point, and therefore his point was, I see it with my own eyes. What do you see with your own eyes? Yeah, there is some movie which is made in some, you know, primitive technique which was available at that time. I'm sure Somebody can make much better movie nowadays how they landed in moon without all these contradictions and different mistakes which they did at that time. So that's what you see with your eyes. But his point was that the evidence which I get from seeing with my eyes is higher than the evidence of the scriptures. And that's basically the foundation of different worldviews. Actually, before subscribing to worldview, one has to establish this very thing. What is Praman? What is the source of verified knowledge? What is the source of proper knowledge in this universe? And if you are a believer, and the capacity of your own eyes to discriminate what is the true knowledge and what is the wrong knowledge, then you will become an atheist. That is equal to say that I don't believe in God. I only believe in my own power of seeing the things as they are. And if I have some little doubt about my ability to see with my own eyes, then it means to say that there may be something which I don't understand and which I will not be able to understand, never will be able to understand with my own eyes. So that's basically what it is, and we know that the theory which is propounded by the materialist or atheist in India, because all the philosophies are basically stemming from Bharatvarsha, you know, all the possible ideas are already described and discussed at length by the sages of the past in Bharatavarsha. Actually, there was one Russian philosopher of the last century. He had to immigrate from Russia and went to America. He was a genius in one sense. He was an amazing person. His name was Zilberman. He went straight from Soviet Russia to America, became a professor in Harvard University, which is the highest university in America. And he died very young in a car accident. He was only 35 years old or something like this. So he basically wrote one book. But in this one book, this one book is a review of six darshanas, of six different systems of Vedic philosophy. And in the conclusion of this book, he says that what we can see from the analysis of these six darshanas is that the only professional philosophy existed in ancient India. Everything which was done in the West is just amateur kind of very childish thing. Everything which is there, all possible ideas, all possible conceptions about the universe, about the world which surrounds us, is already there, and nothing new can be said about this. If you want to know everything about this world, just study these six darshanas, and you will be totally bewildered, but you will know everything about possible speculations which can be done. So that was his conclusion. He said, you know, all this Western attempts to philosophize are so childish in comparison with this professional approach which was there in ancient India. And believe it or not, materialism was also quite professionally described in ancient India by Charvaka Muni. Or some say that Charvaka Muni is just a generic word for materialist. Because actually the word Charvaka means Charuvak. Charuvak means a beautiful speech, or something which is pleasing to the heart. Because the most pleasing philosophy is the philosophy of Charvaka. You know, his famous Vakya, or Mahavakya of his philosophy, just be happy in this world. And, you know, don't have all these hang-ups about the problems, about next life, about, you know, just steal the ghee and enjoy. And that's the main meaning of life. What is more pleasing to our heart than this? Nothing can be more pleasing. And he makes this point with great conviction. He says, this is, you know, this is what it is. This is what the life is all about. This is what the world is all about. Just enjoy your life. Be merry. Be so happy in this life. And, you know, don't have all these problems about the future. Yeah, whatever They will be in future. It's not your problem. So another name of this, of course, another explanation of this word charvaka is from the verbal root charv, which means to chew, you know, which is, again, a very important explanation or important point of our philosophy, that basically his philosophy is the chewing philosophy. You just chew something, and this is the meaning of life. You just eat and sleep and you know, mate and defend, and this is the meaning of the main meaning of life. This is Charvaka's philosophy. But another name of this philosophy is Lokayata, and Lokayata means Lokayata. Lokayata means predominant in this world. Basically. And Vedas also subscribe to these views that materialistic philosophy will always be predominant in this world. Or to speak about age of Kali. In age of Kali, there will be no other philosophy but this philosophy. All other philosophies will be reduced to some kind of insignificance. But the main predominant philosophy of the people of this world will always be this. Just eat and sleep. And whoever will give them justification to follow this path of life, they will celebrate this person. They will congratulate this person. They will make him the greatest philosopher of this world, because this is what people want. They want somebody to say very clearly, this is the meaning of life, there is nothing else here. Because this is the purpose of our existence in this world. We came to this world just to follow this kind of philosophy. And, of course, Charvaka Muni, in a very simple language, but he proves the main tenets of his philosophy. First of all, saying that, of course, the main praman is pratyaksha. Whatever you see, you can only believe is what you see. And he says his main argument against shabda sounds like this. He says that, you know, everyone is a bewildered fool in this world. And he's right in a sense. You know, everyone is a bewildered fool. And everyone is full of doubts. Again, this is right observation. Everyone in this world is full of doubts. You know, we know it ourselves. When we read these descriptions of Srimad Bhagavatam, we cannot help but have some doubts. Is there any ocean of ghee which is so many yojanas wide? So Charvaka Muni says, everyone is just bewildered, everyone is under this moha or illusion, and everyone is full of doubts. And then his natural conclusion is that, if it is so, why should you believe somebody? Why should you believe anyone? Because you can see within your heart and within your mind very clearly, you're full of doubts. And you can suspect that everyone else is also full of doubts. Therefore, the logical conclusion is that everyone is full of doubts, then you should not follow anyone, that you should not believe anyone, you should only believe your own eyes. Logical, isn't it? It's a very good argument. The only problem with this argument that it's based on logic. Whereas according to Charvaka, you cannot come to a right conclusion by using logic. So he contradicts himself even by making this argument, because he is using logic, and he says this is true because it's logical, but it's not logical. First of all, it's not logical because if you are a fool, if you are bewildered, and if your heart is full of doubts, it does not necessarily mean that everyone is full of doubts. There are some people in this world who are not full of doubts. This is the argument number one. The argument number two is that, you know, why do you use logic? Because you cannot come to the conclusion, to the right conclusion, by using logic. And all his arguments are like this. And Baladev Vidyabhushan, he makes a humorous refutation of Charvaka philosophy, of this materialistic philosophy. Because they say you can only believe in what you see. You cannot believe is what you logically conclude. You cannot believe in what the scriptures say. And Baladev Vidyabhushan says, oh, dear Charvaka, why are you so sad? You suspect that your wife is pregnant from her lover, from her paramour. But why are you so sad? You shouldn't be sad because you didn't see it. You didn't see how it happened. So why should you hang up about this? So this is our refutation of Charvaka philosophy. It's not logical. It's not really. You cannot really reduce the world to this foolish and childish idea that you can only believe in what you see, because you don't see so many things, and still you believe in these things. You always use your logic, and you always ultimately have to believe somebody who is more authoritative than you. So this is a very ridiculous statement and ridiculous proposition that you can only believe in what you see. But then the very logical statement, again, in Charvaka's philosophy is that if it's true, if you can only and should only believe in what you see, and you should not believe in anything else, then the logical conclusion is that you should enjoy life. And there is a very deep philosophy behind this, of course. And his statement, again, is few interesting points to make. He says that you should only enjoy life, and if some people say, and there are so many people who say this, that the enjoyment of life, that sense enjoyment, is inevitably connected with the sufferings, you should not take this seriously. One of the main arguments against Charvaka philosophy, just enjoy life, just enjoy unlimitedly, just try to squeeze out your body, is that ultimately you will end up in sufferings. And that's exactly what Krishna says. Krishna says that, what is this? Not Martha Strasbourg. So if you say that from the contact of senses and sense objects you get some bhog, then Nateshwara Mate Buddha, the intelligent man will not do this, because atyanta vanta kaunteya, because sooner or later it will end. If your conception of happiness, if your conception of happy life or joyful life in this world is that you just have to enjoy your senses, then it's not logical. And intelligent people will never do this, because sooner or later even this happiness will end. And even while enjoying this happiness, you will kind of anticipate the end of this happiness. And because of this anticipation, your happiness will be totally spoiled and poisoned. You will not be able even to enjoy this, because you will always be in this anxiety. When it will end, when it will end. If this is the conception of life. But then Charvaka's argument is that, you know, if some people says that there will be some sufferings, this is not a good argument. He says, yes, there will be some sufferings. There is no doubt about it. He doesn't deny it, because this is what we can see. We can see with our own eyes that if you just enjoy, there will be sufferings. And the more you enjoy, the more sufferings will be there. But his argument to this is that you have the intelligence, right? And if you have intelligence, you will be able to find a way to maximize your enjoyment and minimize your sufferings. If you are intelligent materialist, you will not take it for granted that you will have to suffer. You will somehow or other find your way to reduce your sufferings and to increase your enjoyment. He says, and he gives an example. He says, you know, if you eat fish, and because we are Bengali Vaishnavas, it's a very dear argument for us, because Bengalis usually eat fish. You know, he says, if you eat fish, there are some bones in the fish, and the bones are, you know, very sharp. But intelligent person will not reject eating fish just on the basis that there are some bones there. You know, intelligent person, he will try to find a way how to discriminate between the bone and the you know, delicious flesh of the fish. That was his argument, which is foolish, again, which is very foolish. But some people do believe it because they want to believe it, because they really want to believe it. And then, of course, Charvaka Muni And this is perhaps the most important point of his philosophy, or so-called philosophy, which is Gnostic philosophy. He gives a very thorough refutation of the Vedas, because the scriptures all over the world, not only in India, but wherever you go, you will have the conception of God. Everywhere. You know, people do come to this conception, and especially scriptures guide, and they explain that there is God and there is some kind of, you know, intelligence behind everything which we see. And we can see it. It's also very logical to suspect or to conclude that there is some intelligence behind what we see. So one of the main points of Charvaka philosophy, of this materialistic atheistic philosophy, is that we have to reject the Vedas. Why? On which basis we reject the Vedas, he says. He gives the three arguments. He says, first argument is about the Vedas itself. He says the Vedas, and he more or less repeats what is there in Nyaya Sutra. But Nyaya Sutra refutes this argument, and it is said the Vedas has three defects. First of all, he says, anrita. Anrita means lie. First defect of the Vedas is that there is so much lies there, so much cheating is there. And then he says, the second argument, his second argument against the Vedas, so against the scriptures, and we see, you know, so many things which are seemingly, you know, cannot be fit into our materialistic or atheistic concept of life, is there in the scriptures. So this, he says, this is anrita. Then he says there is another defect in the Vedas, self-contradictory nature of the Vedas. In one place it is said that something, in another place something totally, completely opposite it is there. And you can find this. You know, believe it or not, just by using your primitive logic, you will find the contradictory statement even in Srimad Bhagavatam. Even in Srimad Bhagavatam, in the 10th canto, I just recently read this. It's interesting. In the 10th canto, it is said that bhakti is coming from following the vows, from performing karma, from following the some, from performing tapasya. In the 11th canto, it is said exactly the opposite. It is said bhakti is never coming from these things. So it's there. The contradictions is there. Of course, if you're intelligent enough, you will find a way how to explain all these contradictions, and acharyas are there to explain this. But Charvaka says, look, you know, this is contradictions, this is anrita, lie is there. And then he says, punarukta. Another defect of the Vedas is this redundancy. The Vedas again and again repeat the same things, you know, what is the use? And sometimes people even use, and sometimes even devotees, I have heard this, that devotees use exactly the same arguments against Srila Prabhupada's writing. Oh, so-called devotees, or devotees who are about to leave the movement. They say, you know, why Srila Prabhupada repeats the same thing again and again and again? I am not this body, I am not this body, I am not this body. You know, sometimes when I hear this, I'm almost tempted to say that Srila Prabhupada didn't say it enough, because you didn't understand it still. Even though he repeated so many times, you still don't understand this. So, and sometimes people say Prabhupada contradicts himself, you know, he says something and then he says something opposite. You know, in Bhagavad Gita, in the first chapter of Bhagavad Gita, in one verse, in the purport, Srila Prabhupada says Arjuna is so, you know, he is a soft-hearted Vaishnava and he's so nice, therefore he is crying now, and therefore he is in such a depression now. And the next purport he says he's just a, you know, he's just afraid. He's just a coward. He's just totally materialistic person, and therefore he is so sad. You know. So what it is? He's soft-hearted Vaishnava, or he's a materialist. You know. So the contradiction is there. But there is an intelligent way of understanding this, and that's why it is so important to understand and try to understand shastras on a regular basis every day of our life. Because at one point of life, we may have some doubts. And therefore, all these generic arguments are there. As I said in the beginning, Charvaka Muni or any Vedic philosophy basically gives all the generic arguments to any worldview. And you can find the complete system of materialism in Charvaka Muni's description. And then he says, he gives two more arguments against the followers of the Vedic path. He says, first of all, Vedas are wrong because of these three reasons. Second of all, those who follow the Vedas, they contradict each other. Somebody says the essence of Vedas is karma. Another one is say the essence of Vedas is jnan. The main goal of Vedas is jnan. And somebody else says, you know, who is sitting here, that the essence of the Vedas is bhakti, you know. So what is the essence of Vedas? Just reject this. Just because the followers of the Vedas cannot really agree with each other, you know, you should just reject this all nonsense and enjoy life. And then what is the next argument? I don't remember the next argument, but it really doesn't matter. You know, I don't want to spoil your consciousness by, you know, citing all these stupid arguments, because this is all ultimately ridiculous. This is all ultimately foolish, and this is all ultimately there to justify the weaknesses of the heart. As much as Arjuna in the first chapter of Bhagavad Gita gives all kinds of shastric arguments to justify the weakness of the heart. You know, he's weak in his heart. He doesn't understand. He lost his clear vision. He is attached to his conception. He is attached to his false ego, his false ideas of this world. And therefore, he is using the scriptures, or he is using the logic, or he is using all kinds of stuff just to justify the weakness of the heart. And this is the nature of the mind. The nature of our mind is like this. Because the mind is weak, there will be a tendency of self-deception. In fact, it is said in Srimad Bhagavatam that Lord Brahma, while creating this universe, he created five coverings of ignorance. And one of these coverings of ignorance is this self-deception. And these self-deceptive mechanisms are so clearly and so strongly established within our psyche that it's very difficult to even to fight with them. That's why you need guru. That's why you need somebody whom you trust completely. Without this, you will be destined to cheat yourself. You will be destined to be to deceive yourself, and you will be basically you will find yourself in this strange situation as all these charvakas and the followers of all other philosophies. And of course, the main argument against this kind of worldview, the main and the most important argument which we really have to know, is given by Krishna himself. Krishna himself describes this philosophy of the atheists. Where does he describe this in Bhagavad Gita? Yes, 16th chapter. Asatyam apratishtam te jagat ahura nishvaram aparasparam sambhutam kimanyat kam haitukam. He says, this is what demons think. Asatyam, there is no sat, there is no truth. Satyam, and Vishwana Chakravarti Thakur explains this verse. He says, when Krishna says asatyam, he means there is no Vedas. Because sat means also Vedas. Sat means the truth which is shabda, which is described in the words of the scriptures. And when Krishna says the first foundation of demonic worldview is asatyam, there is no Vedas. There is no scriptures which you have to believe, which you should follow. Asatyam, this is the main thing about the atheistic worldview. And then apratishtam teya jagat ahura nishvaram, there is no God. And apratishtam, there is no foundation. There is basically, everything is relative. Like Einstein says, you know, the theory of relativity, everything is relative. You know, everything, there is no absolute truth. There is nothing absolute you have to measure yourself against. You're relative, the world is relative, all the truths, all the words here in this world are relative. Therefore, you know, you basically have to believe whatever you like to believe. Lord Krishna says, asatyam apratishtam te jagat ahura nishvaram. This whole world is without God, is without intelligence, is without ruler. This world is chaotic. And of course, when we go out, especially in India, in Bombay, you can believe it. That, you know, it's just chaos. There is no ruler. But He says, ultimately, it's demonic to think like this. Asatyam apratishtam te jagataho iranishvaram aparasparam sambhutam. Then he says, Baladeva Vidyabhushan explains that he says this is the sambhutam, this is svabhaviki, or this natural conception of Buddhists. Buddhists say that this some natural reason is there. You know, there is nothing intelligent behind the world. There is no intelligence. It's just some natural reason. And then he says, kimanyat kamahai to come. So what is... There is no other reason, just calm. No other reason. No other essence of life. There is no other, impetus to live. Just kama. Kama means whimsical. Just be whimsical. Just live in a whimsical way. And just lead your whimsical life and just follow your kama, whims or desires within your heart. And that's it. But then Krishna gives the argument against this. What is the argument against this? Very clear. If you lead this life, you will destroy yourself and you will destroy the world around us. So this is the strongest argument which we have to see very clearly. If you subscribe to this worldview, it will be self-destructive. It will totally destroy your own life, your own body, your own happiness ultimately. And it will destroy the world. And we can see that this self-destructive path of this world, the whole world is following it, and the whole world is going to hell. You know, the whole world. And then Lord Krishna says, the demons who follow this path, this destruction, Ugra Karma, the demons who really, by subscribing to these views, who practically destroy the whole world, what they do, he says, it says they become like crocodiles because graha means crocodile. Baladeva Vidyabhushan explains the next verse in this way. He says that their desires within their heart becomes like crocodiles and that they devoured by these desires. The whole world is being devoured by this, you know, insatiable lust, insatiable greed to enjoy more and more and more. And ultimately, this is the destruction of the world. This is the end of the world. You know, when I come to India, whenever I come to India, I see this very conscious propaganda year after year, because I come usually once a year. I see how it is, and I have some time, some distance, and I see how within 1 year there is one more step of degradation. One more step, you know. Yesterday I was flying on this flight to come here, and there was this, you know, I opened a newspaper in Calcutta. What did they talk? You know, there's some little local newspaper in Calcutta. What did they talk? The most interesting topic. The whole newspaper is about this, or more or less about this, was about gay marriages and some, you know, in the, some state, in Wisconsin state of United States, whether they allow this or not, you know. It's very important for the inhabitants of Calcutta what they will decide in Wisconsin so that they may follow this path. You know, and then the next page is, you know, a few obnoxious advertisement, and, you know, it is all full of this kind of stuff. And this is, you know, Calcutta. this is India, you know. Somebody told me that he opened also again a magazine in India Today. So what do they talk about? Is it good to have sex before marriage or not? And there are some authorities, some great Mahajans. And they say, why not? You know, some movie star says, you know, yeah, it may not be so good to have sex before marriage, but some extra sex within marriage is okay. What's wrong with it? Some little extra sex, what's wrong with it? There's nothing wrong. It's just common knowledge. You just be civilized, you know. Just follow the footsteps of all these demons and be happy. You know, that's what it is. There is such a conscious propaganda to destroy any decent culture. You know, the obscenity is just ruling the world. And that's what it is. That's what's going on. And that's exactly what Lord Krishna says. This is the path of destruction. This is Ugra Karma. And this is, you know, ultimately it will bring about within your heart this crocodile of lust. And this crocodile of lust will grow. And he will become more and more greedy. And ultimately he will devour this whole life and the whole thing. And this is what Krishna says. So you just have to choose. If you want to follow this path of self-destruction, you're most welcome. You know, just join the club. If you don't want to do this, if you don't want to do this, then there is another path. Then you have to believe that there is God. And ultimately there is the supreme will, and you have to follow his will, his desire, not your own desire, not your own lust within your heart, but his desire, and fulfill his desire. And in this way, achieve real happiness, which is everlasting happiness, which is not the limited and ridiculous happiness of this world, completely spoiled by all kinds of unwanted things. But in this way, you will achieve lasting happiness. And again, this is experimentally proven. If you follow this path, you become happy. You know, two Russian ladies, somehow or other, by some inconceivable desire of the Lord, came to Mayapur festival. They knew something about the devotees, and they wanted to go to Sai Baba's ashram. But somebody on the way told them, just before going to Sai Baba, go to Mayapur, because there is some nine islands, and if you go through these nine islands, then you will be immersed in love. And they didn't know anything. They didn't know anything, you know. And they came to Mayapur, you know, and they looked at the devotees. And they looked at the kirtans, and they took part in the kirtans, and they tasted prasadam, and they gave up their tickets to Sai Baba, and they say, we stay here, you know. We don't want to go anywhere else. We are happy here. Why should we go anywhere else? They want to go through the whole parikram, through the whole festival, then they want to come to Bombay here, you know. So that's what it is. Just a few minutes of experiencing this way of life. And this is pratyaksha. This is the main pratyaksha which we have. This is the way to be happy. And this is the real way to be happy. So, thank you very much. Srila Prabhupada ki. Okay. Is there any questions? Yes, Srila Prabhupada.
Thank you, Maharaj, for the very nice class. Maharaj, in India, Bharat Varsha, actually, we who have been born over here and literally have grown up understanding about Krishna and Vishnu and the various demigods, somehow right from our early childhood, we have been told that the Supreme Personality of Godhead is Vishnu. And Krishna is just an incarnation of Vishnu. And this has been drilled into our heads. And we have been told that there are so many temples of Vishnu in South India. So that, and for us to get this conditioning out of our system, and once we came in the association of devotees, to recognize that actually Vishnu is an expansion, the expansion, the expansion of Krishna, itself took so much of time. So the doubt comes to our mind, Maharaj, is how in a place like Moscow, where they have not even heard about Krishna or Vishnu, such wonderful devotees are practicing Krishna consciousness. What is the way by which they are really getting this conviction that Krishna is the Supreme Personality of Godhead?
It's easier for us because we were not brought up in this culture which believes that Vishnu is the Supreme Lord. And basically, and this is the miracle which Prabhupada created. He said, Krishna is the Supreme Personality of Godhead. And I remember, and his logic behind this statement is very peculiar. He says in one place, Krishna is the Supreme Personality of Godhead because he himself says this. Aham sarvasya prabhava, matah sarvam pravartade. Idi matva bhajanti mam buddha bhava samanvita. But he says it in such a conviction that, you know, we have no choice but to believe it. He says, yeah, he's God. It's obvious. He gave this Vedic scriptures. He explained Vedic scriptures with such clarity and such simplicity, and that it can be understood even by a child. And this explanation is actually so compelling. I remember myself, because I'm a scientist, and being a scientist means being bewildered. This is what science means. By background, I was a scientist, and I was brought up in this materialistic kind of background and environment. My father was an atheist, my mother was an atheist, my grandfather was an atheist, my grandmother was an atheist. So I'm the third generation of atheists, so I'm a very... There is a parampara there. So, and I was brought up in this conception when I was small, when I would go to kindergarten, you know. We would learn some mantras. There is no God, there is no God, there is no God. So I didn't know who God is, but there was no... He didn't exist. That much I knew. So being brought up in this conditioning, so to speak... When I first read Prabhupada's books, I had so many arguments against his statements. And of course, all these arguments which Charvaka Muni says, I had in my mind. There are some contradictions, there is some redundancy there is some things which, you know, cannot be true, just because it cannot be true, just because I had never seen something like this. And I remember for approximately 1 year, I had a constant, that's what Prabhupada did to me. And it was quite a severe test. For 1 year, there was a courtroom within my mind. And there was a lawyer which would defend the atheistic point of view, and there was a prosecutor which was, you know, saying by Prabhupada's words, God is there, God is there, God is there. For 1 year, there was this proceeding was going on. There were arguments back and forth, back and forth, back and forth. But after 1 year, I could understand that all my arguments are finished. I don't have any more arguments. That's it. You know. Approximately after 1 year, there was, after this process of, you know, arguing back and forth, I understood that I don't have good arguments. All my arguments, I have arguments, but they're not good. Some advantage by some inconceivable good luck I had is that I was little honest within my heart, and I could understand, you know, I cannot refute this. If I cannot refute this, I have to accept this, and very unwillingly I did accept it, and here I am. So, and this is Prabhupada. This is what Prabhupada did. He gave this, and he... his explanation, the beauty of his explanation, that it's totally non-sectarian. He is not speaking from any sectarian point of view. He is speaking from a purely universal point of view, and he gives all these universal arguments, and these universal arguments are compelling. You cannot do anything about it. And I know so many people who became devotees just because they couldn't refute. I know one lady. She was a very powerful, she's a very powerful lady. She's a politician. She's an extremely powerful lady. And her mother became a devotee. She read Prabhupada's books. And this lady was so upset, and she was so angry, and she was so... And then, you know, she was arguing and arguing with the mother, and then she decided, let me read these books, and I will read this book, and I will know the argument, and then I will defeat this. And she read these books, and then she became a devotee. She said, I cannot do anything. I have to do it now. I have to do it. I have no other choice. So that's what it is. Okay.
Thank you so much. Haribol. It was very analytical. It did stimulate a lot of analytical approach to Krishna consciousness, which is essential at times to deepen our convictions. So thank you for that. Is it that we always accept things on Shabda Praman? Like in your class also you mentioned that a lot of things in spiritual life we accept as reality based on seeing. You see happy devotees, and you think this must be true because they're looking happy, so it must be true that... Or we say, for example, that Keval Ananda Kanda,
that Mahaprabhu's philosophy is always blissful. But there are so many miserable devotees practicing Krishna consciousness. Mm-hmm. So, is it that, okay, I have to always accept Shabda Praman? I am unhappy because of whatever reasons, but Keval Ananda, I will be happy, I will be happy. That is the reality. My whole experience is false. It's not true, whatever.
No. Actually, Madhvacharya, when he describes different pramanas, he gives preference to Pratyaksha Praman. Although he definitely accepts Shabda, there is no doubt about it, but he gives a very important place to Pratyaksha. Because he says that ultimately to believe something, you have to experience something. But our approach to this is that we accept all pramanas. We accept Anuman, we accept Shabda, and we accept Pratyaksha, Praman. But we say that the main praman is Shabda Praman. And we only accept Anuman and Pratyaksha, which is non-contradictory to Shabda. If we have some experience which contradicts Shabda, then we don't accept this experience. But if we have experience which in accordance with Shabda, then we very happily embrace this experience. It says, yes. So when we see the happiness which is obtained from this source, from the spiritual source, we obtain it. When we see the happiness which is obtained from the material source, and there is happiness, there is no doubt about it, we reject it. Because it contradicts Shabda. Because we know that there is some kind of poisonous part of this happiness. It's not all, it's not Kevala Anandakanda. It's Mishra Anandakanda. There is some mixture there, not Kevala. So that's what it is. Our approach is that our primary praman is Shabda. And whatever is non-contradictory within our logic and within our experience, whatever is not contradictory, we accept. Whatever is contradictory, we reject. Just as simple as this, because we have enough reasons to believe Shabda. We have enough reasons to believe Aptas, the people who realize the truth of the scriptures, the people who knows what it is all about, the people who knows what it means to have an ocean of ghee, you know. I don't know what it is. Even Prabhupada said, you know, I don't know what it is. You know? But you should figure it out. But we just accept it. As simple as this, yeah, there must be some ocean of ghee, ultimately.
Maharaj, Hare Krishna. You were saying in the class that as and when every year you come to India, you see that one after another, the downgradation is going down and down and down. And you were reading some magazines, India Today and all those things. And from where you come to a conclusion that the degradation is becoming more and more stiffer and stiffer and stiffer. In that circumstances, and we see specifically, as you have said in the class also, in Bombay is becoming more and more degraded. And we see everywhere, day by day, it's becoming so degraded that for a devotee it becomes extremely difficult to maintain his proper consciousness. Mm-hmm. To maintain the high standard which Prabhupada has given us, to maintain that status quo itself is finding it difficult, and sometimes that fear is there in our mind that whether we'll be able to maintain our Krishna consciousness for the whole lifetime or not, seeing so much high temptation from Maya is coming up. So I wanted to know that in that circumstance, when that fear is there in our heart and so much temptation is coming and we are not so strong enough also that we can counteract so easily, philosophical conviction we have not have got so much strong enough that any time that temptation comes, we can easily contract it out. We have to fight and fight and fight, and sometimes that fight becomes so stiff that we feel that we have got defeated. And once we get defeated, again to come back on the same level of Krishna consciousness becomes extremely difficult. So in that circumstances, what should a devotee do so that he can maintain his Krishna consciousness till the fag end of his life?
One has to become strong. The point is that if we remain weak, then of course we will easily fall victim of all these temptations and seductions and everything of this life. But one has to become strong, and there is sources of strength. Krishna himself says, Balam Balavatam Chaham, I am the source of strength, of spiritual strength, Bala. And Balaram, being the representative of spiritual master, is the source of spiritual strength. Prabhupada explains in 7th canto of Srimad Bhagavatam that Balaram, as the representative of spiritual master, of guru, being Adi Guru, he gives you the strength to lift up the sword of knowledge and to cut off the shackles of Maya. So there is knowledge, and the knowledge is there in the scriptures. The knowledge is there in Srila Prabhupada's books. But we have to be strong enough to use this knowledge. We have to be strong enough to imbibe this knowledge. And for that, a spiritual master is there. He gives us the strength to understand the spiritual knowledge and to use the spiritual knowledge, to use it as a sword. And of course, Sangha of the devotees is a very important source of strength. And the individual spiritual practice is another source of strength. This is all, you know, as Krishna himself explains in Bhagavad Gita, in the very last verse of Bhagavad Gita, the last verse of the third chapter, where this problem of karma is being dealt with. Arjuna basically asks the same question. He says, I know what is wrong, what is right, but sometimes I anyway act contrary to this. What is this force which pushes me to do? And Krishna ensues this discussion about the nature of lust, and he says, it's indeed a very ferocious enemy which is there within your heart, which is insatiable, which is, you know, all-devouring. It can devour all your intelligence. And then he says that intelligence can be more and more covered there. But in the very last verse, he gives the hint. In the verse before the last, he gives the hint. He says, the intelligence is the highest in the hierarchy of everything else. The last is there in the senses. The last is there in the heart. The last is there in the mind. And the last is there in the intelligence. And then he says, the soul is the highest in the hierarchy. But intelligence is next to the soul. And then in the very last verse, he says, you have to connect your intelligence with the higher intelligence. And by this connection of your intelligence with the higher intelligence, you should conquer over this dead enemy of yours. What is this? Mahabaho, Jahishatru, Evam Budhyev Parambudva, Samstabhyatmanam Atmana. Jahishatru Mahabaho. So, Jahishatru Mahabaho, you have to take this, you have to use your intelligence, and for that you have to sharpen your intelligence or strengthen your intelligence. You are right. We are weak because our intelligence is weak. How you make your intelligence sharp? By making it, by coming into connection with the source of the higher intelligence or the source of spiritual strength, which is Guru, which is the words of the scriptures, which is your own individual practice, which is the association of devotees. In this way, when you keep your intelligence in this strong position, then you will be able to fight with it. If not, then definitely, for sure, you are destined to fall victim of it. So basically, whole Krishna consciousness, and Prabhupada writes it, when he explains this term, Buddhi Yoga, he says the whole Krishna consciousness is about developing intelligence. And that's what exactly what Krishna says also. And the end of Bhagavad Gita, he says, I explain to you everything till the end, till the minute details, but now use your own intelligence and fight. So, Bhagavad Gita is, and the scriptures and the practice of Krishna consciousness are supposed to strengthen our intelligence for us to become strong. Okay, I guess it's already late. Thank you very much. Srila Prabhupada ki, His Holiness Srila Radhanatha Maharaja ki, Gaura Premananda.